is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.
Wade, it opens wide for Wade. What a dunk! Fournier blocks his dunk! Here's Wade against Green. Euroskill. Basket.
Welcome to the Heat Check. I'm Wes Goldberg. With me, as always, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
Doing pretty good, man. Trying to hang in there through the dog days of the NBA offseason, but so far, so good.
Not much going on the Heat front, the NBA front, really. So we're going to take this podcast. We haven't done one in a few weeks. We're going to take this one to kind of look back and talk about some of the greatest Heat players ever over on allyoucanheat.com. This past week, we did a breakdown of the top five players in Heat history at each position, starting at point guard and moving on through center. So we're going to discuss those lists right here.
Can't wait.
So let's get right into it. We'll start at point guard. Number one, I have Tim Hardaway, 2, Sherman Douglas, 3, Mario Chalmers, 4, Jason Williams, and 5, Bimbo Coles. So let's just start there. What do you think, Dave? Are you okay with that list?
I think it's a good list. I think when you look at the overall production that each of those players had while they were in Miami, it kind of warrants where they are. Maybe they didn't necessarily have the best years of their career there, but I guess in terms of overall production, those were great. I mean, the jury's still out on how Goran Dragic will have an impact in Miami, so you can't really include him in the list. You know, there have been other point guards throughout the Heat history that might merit some consideration. Maybe Brian Shaw. Maybe Keon Dooling and others. I mean, they've had some pretty decent backup point guards throughout the course of the franchise history. But I'd say that the five that you listed there pretty much represent the very best that Miami had to offer.
Yeah, and the Heat have been kind of a point guard really wasn't the Heat strong suit going through. I mean, it's typically a big man franchise if you look at the history of it. It's not a lot of point guard play, some small forwards, some shooting guards that obviously stand out. Tim Hardaway, obviously, is your top point guard. That's not debatable. Then you're looking at guys like Sherman Douglas, Chalmers, Jason Williams, Bimbo Coles, guys that probably wouldn't make the top five of a lot of franchises, all-time point guards. But, we look at this, and just the fact that Mario Chalmers is at number 3, and the amount of flack he gets from fans, that our favorite topic on this show, the fact that he's at 3, that Jason Williams played, 2 years in Miami? 3?
Yeah.
But won a championship, was extremely impactful in those couple years. Fact that he's 4.
That's worth debating, though. I mean, how much of that was Jason Williams well past his peak, perhaps, at that point?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the fact that he was still a fairly big name, and that he was overall an exciting player. I mean, he was clearly the fourth banana on that team. I mean, he was the starting point guard, but Shaquille O'Neal and Dwayne Wade dominated that roster. How much of that was just that he was in the right time for the right team?
Yeah, it was very situational, because I think what he did, he allowed Wade to be exclusively a shooting guard, because Williams at that point of his career, he was a distributor, he was a facilitator. He was able to just call the plays and just maintain the pace of the game. And that allowed Wade to do his thing and have his best season of his career to that point. So I think it was very situational. And I actually wrote this post, the top five point guards. And when I said breaking down Jason Williams, it was just he allowed Wade to be even better. And I guess it didn't have to be Jason Williams. It could have been any above average point guard at that point. It just happened to be Jason Williams. And the Heat don't have a lot of great point guards in their history, and that's good enough to warrant number 4, or at least round out the top five of the best point guards in Heat history.
Really good point there, that the Heat as a franchise hasn't put a hell of a lot of emphasis on developing the point guard position. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a stopgap position. You even look at the Big Three era, it was probably the worst position on the roster. I mean, the center position wasn't quite as developed there, but not until they went positionless and moved Chris Bosh into the center spot. But, you know, they just haven't put a lot of focus on the point guards. They just had guys kind of coming in and out over the course of their franchise history. Right. Not until, you know, Tim Hardaway, he was, and this is also, you know, you look at the reclamation history for Miami Heat, you know, Hardaway, as big a name as he was in Golden State and part of Front TMC and, you know, Hall of Fame candidate, there was some legitimate concern about him being able to play because of the overall health of his knees. And he was able to keep his career going by for a number of years here. For all the problems that he wound up having with Miami and Pat Riley on his way out of the franchise, you know, I saw a video recently of him in a Denver Nuggets uniform. I had totally forgotten that even happened. Like, it's I blanked out the whole post-Heat history. I know he played for the Pacers, the Mavericks, the Nuggets. I can't remember any other team he might have played for. But at some point, it just looked like, you know, desperately trying to cling to a job in the NBA. But, you know, Hardaway was the definitive point guard for the Miami Heat during that great era of basketball in the mm-hmm. 90s. And I mean, I think he's one that the fans remember very, very fondly. And that's another point that I want to make now is that, you know, so much of these lists are, like you said, situational, like
right.
how a fan feels about a particular player when they come in at just the right moment and are a perfect fit. Even if they're not as productive necessarily as you remember them being, you kind of remember them more with your heart than your mind, if you know what I'm saying. And so that's kind of where Jason Williams to me fits in. Is that maybe he wasn't necessarily, as you pointed out, not necessarily as productive at that point in his career, but he came in at just the right point and he was able to help Wade develop to that next level. And he was part of a really exciting 2005-2016.
100%. Jason Williams is a complete emotional pick. Yeah, but I had to have him in there.
I get it.
So, because, again, I mean, that should factor into it, I guess. I mean, when you have not a lot of pickings as far as point guards go, maybe that's what gets you in the top five, is just an emotional attachment and what kind of the situation you're in. I mean, Chalmers by no means is probably not the third most talented point guard in Heat history, if we're just going by talent, but... and discounting Goran Dragic just because he's not played a full season, so I just kind of left him off. For those wondering, like he's not on the list, but he won two championships here, and has kind of just stuck around. I mean, he's basically the evolved form of Bimbo Coles. Bimbo Coles was just a backup his whole career, and he's number five on the list. He just stuck around long enough to make his way on, you know, a bunch of assist leaderboards in Heat history, so I was just like, all right, good enough. So
his first name is Vernell, isn't it? You know,
yeah, it's something like that, but he goes by Bimbo, right? So,
of course, I mean, why would you call him anything but Bimbo Cole? It's right. Probably one of the greatest names in NBA history, right?
It's a good one, it's definitely a good one. So, let's move on to the shooting guard spot. Number five, Harold Miner. Four, Kevin Edwards. Number three is Eddie Jones. Number two is Steve Smith. And do you care to guess who number one is, Dave?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably Dwayne Wade.
It is Dwayne Wade. Good job. So,
thanks, man.
Yeah, well, you know, you're on the podcast for a reason. let's debate this one. This is a little bit of... This is a nifty one, I think.
Yes. I'd say the... of Harold Miner is arguably the most indefensible one of all the five lists there. Because he wasn't really good while he was in Miami. He didn't have much of an NBA career, period, but he certainly wasn't very productive in the couple of seasons that he spent in Miami. And maybe it's not fair to say that it was or wasn't his fault. He wasn't very good here. He had a lot of expectations. He might have been one of those first players to carry that kind of the stigma of being Jordan-esque as far as his overall style was concerned. He was a lottery pick for Miami, and he had that nickname, Baby Jordan, for whatever reason, and it kind of stuck with him, unfortunately. I guess for anybody who was trying to, you know, or hoping that they could get somebody within the same sphere as Jordan, he was going to fall well short of that, with the exception of winning two slam dunk competitions while with the Miami Heat. So there's certainly that, but that's pretty much all that he did. I don't think he was capable of much else. He wasn't much of a shooter. He was an effective finisher at the rim, but other than that, he wasn't a very good defender. And
He didn't start many games, averaged 10 points for his two seasons.
That was a kind of a weak moment in Heat history there. Like, they weren't really well-defined at that point, and he kind of fit in there and just wasn't very effective.
So who do you have at taking that five spot then?
That's a tough one. To me, I think you could either put Dan Majerle or Rashawn Leonard. I know either one of those, you know, Rashawn Leonard was a bench player at some points, and then he was kind of a two-guard. Majerle kind of went from the two spot to the three on occasion. But either one, again, going back to the Hardaway thing, maybe over to the Jason Williams thing, the emotions attached to those teams from the mid to late 90s, of which Leonard and Majerle were both a part of, kind of propel them above whatever production Harold Miner may have had in his 2 years. If you're looking at it as far as just basic production, you know, Harold Miner averaged 10 points per game over the 2 years he was in Miami. But who cares what Dan Marley's production was? He was Thunder Dan, and that was a big part. He was a great player in 1993 when the Phoenix Suns challenged the Chicago Bulls in the NBA Finals. He was an Olympian. He was, you know, a recognizable name that Miami acquired, and he was a very solid player while he was here. You know, he wasn't the linchpin of that team. You know, again, at that point in his career, very much a complimentary player in the sense that he wasn't going to take over any kind of points or minutes away from Zoe or Tim Hardaway or other guys like Jamal Mashburn, but he fit in very well. He defended some really incredible two guards at that point in time, and he provided the occasional dunk and three-pointer. You know, he was great. He was great. So it's tough to say. But Sean Leonard almost exclusively was just a shooter from the perimeter, and that was great. But I don't know. You're probably too young to remember Dr. Jack Ramsey yelling out Leonard as he hits a game winner from the corner. I mean, that's like one of the greatest moments in Heat history. You have to go way back, and you probably have to be the quote-unquote Heat lifer to remember that. But those were really great moments in Heat history.
I would have went Marley at 5-2. I think just the combination of his specialization as a three-point shooter, what he could do when he came to the Heat, right about that time, I would have went there too. I could see why it was Harold Miner at 5, like you said, because the stats, I guess, were a little bit impressive. Maybe inflated because really not much was going on in Miami at that point. But the top four, I'm okay with. I think Wade and Steve Smith and Eddie Jones are easily the top three, right? That's not debatable. And I think you can kind of just play with a few other names to round that out.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. We should also mention, probably, and I'm sure Zach Harper of CBS Sports would probably love us mentioning Ricky Davis, pre-career here in Miami. He might merit some consideration there, at least in the five spot.
Sure. I have no reason to not consider him. All right, well, let's keep moving along to small forward now. Breaking down this list, number 5, Keith Askins. 4, Shane Battier. Number 3, Jamal Mashburn. Number 2, Glenn Rice. Number 1, obviously, LeBron James. Any issues with this list? Any comments?
James, the fact that he played both the small and power forward position, would that change your perception of where he ranks as far as top five small forwards of all time? Does he merit some inclusion as far as a top five power forward of all time? I went through this issue some ways back with another website where I was ranking the top shooting guards of all time, and somebody else was preparing a list of top point guards of all time, and they asked me, well, where do you have Allen Iverson ranked? And he typically played that point guard, but he was really a shooting guard, right? I mean, or he played a shooting guard, but he was more of a point guard. So how do you fit in a player like that where they kind of play a yet to be defined role in the team? You know,
so we had that issue. So I had to get together with the two staffers that wrote these, and basically said, and I just made a decision. I'm like, LeBron's a small forward for the sake of this exercise. Like, historically speaking, they're gonna look. We're gonna look back at LeBron as a small forward. So let's just rank him as a small forward. I have no problem if somebody wanted to count LeBron as their power forward, but for all intents and purposes, he's a small forward. So we just kept him there. Because what I didn't want was LeBron to be on two lists. I just didn't want that.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense, absolutely.
But it was a conversation we had to have.
Of course. Now, could you make the argument, based on overall production, that maybe Glenn Rice was a better small forward here? It's where you kind of swing things, right? If you're looking at overall production, yeah, sure, he didn't win two MVP trophies while he was here, but that's a whole other story for a whole other podcast as far as what the merits of that position are or the criteria for that award are. But could you make the argument that maybe Glenn Rice was a better small forward during the time that he was here in Miami?
See, this is what I was afraid of, because he was great here. But he averaged 19.5 points per game with the Heat, total.
Glenn Rice.
Right, Glenn Rice. And I can't remember exactly what LeBron did, but it was definitely more than that. It was at least 20 sure. points a game. So, he's 26.9 for points per game. I have it right here. So I think overall production, LeBron still takes it. I think people in the post-LeBron leaving Miami almost want to just give the edge to Glenn Rice because he's a retro Heat player and it's he's kind of represents more of a Heat lifer, so to speak, I guess, because he just represents like a big part of Miami Heat history. But I don't see how you could possibly put LeBron over Glenn or Glenn Rice over LeBron James. LeBron won two titles, completely changed the face of this franchise forever. Two MVPs, was unbelievably productive, helped his teammates in a million ways, did all the things that LeBron James does. Yeah.
No, you're right. You're right. I mean, it's one of the interesting things or arguments that you could possibly make there, but it's a good point that you bring up in as far as how Glenn Rice is framed in hindsight as a quote-unquote Heat lifer, and there's some nostalgia involved with the time that he was with Miami as opposed to the bitterness caused by LeBron's departure. So
it would have been too much of a hipster move to make him number one. It just would have been.
A good point. That's a good point. We're trying to avoid that whenever possible on this podcast.
Absolutely. It's not a hipster podcast.
No, that's elsewhere.
Jamal Mashburn, Shane Battier, Keith Askins. I really like Battier being included in this top five. I really do.
Not fourth, though. Not over Askins.
I would probably agree with you there, but I think his name just being in that top five, I'm a big believer that we need to take Battier. We need to include him when we're talking about this team historically, because the numbers aren't necessarily there. Like, his three-point shooting percentage was very good, save for his last season here. He was the glue guy. He kind of put everything together. Things kind of just fit better when he was on the court. Everything made more sense. He's just one of those retro kind of players that just keep things together, but he's also able to mold and adapt into the modern game. Went from shooting guard in Memphis, basically, to a power forward in Miami at some point, guarding power forwards in Miami. I mean, the guy just did what he needed to do, and if people like you and I who love basketball, analyze basketball, and we swear up and down that basketball is more than a game of numbers, then we have to include Battier and not worry about the numbers, just for the sheer impact he had on the team and how everything just fit better when he was involved. So I love Battier being on this list, because there's a number of guys that had better production than Battier during their time in Miami that didn't make this list.
I have to agree with you. I mean, you want to hear the ridiculous cliche, but he won everywhere he went. I mean, with the exception of that, his limited 10 years in Houston and Memphis, he won in high school, he won in college, he won in the pros, and he was a big part of that. And I know that's, a lot of that has to do with the kind of overall talent and the strength of his roster, and he was at just the right time to join the Miami Heat, but he made that that team better. He allowed for LeBron to do the kinds of things that LeBron did, or for Wade to slack a little bit defensively, or the fact that we didn't have a real good rim protector in there. It freed a lot of the players to do what they did well, and that's the beauty of Shane Battier's game and the strength of why he deserves to be on this list. So I'm with you 100%.
His skill, I think Battier's greatest skill was making other great players greater. That was probably his number one skill, right?
Crap, that's as cliche as it gets, right? I mean, isn't that the knock on Kobe early in his career?
Right, Carmelo Anthony. Yeah.
Michael Jordan, yeah, that they didn't make players better until later on in their careers. But, I mean, you're right. If you look at it from that perspective and that necessarily he's not improving their game, that their overall talent is going to shine through anyway, but he allows them to maximize what they do best,
mm-hmm.
then that works. And in Battier's case, he played solid defense. He was, occasionally cheap. People didn't like him for whatever reason. Maybe it's the attachment to Duke. Maybe he was too smart for his own good. Maybe he defended you a little too tightly or whatever, and people disliked it. But he was an essential part of those two championship winning teams, and he was great while he was here. I mean, his emphasis on the community, Battiogi, all the kinds of things that he did here locally, you have to take that into consideration. And yeah, he was a hell of a spokesperson for the NBA in general, not just for the Heat. But it was great that he represented it. He represented this team very well for 3 years, and certainly merits being on this list.
So I think you and I are convinced that Battier is on this list, but for any listeners, any holdouts, my final point on Battier is, at the end of this podcast, we're going to do a final top five starting lineup for all-time Miami Heat team. But let's go a little bit further for the sake of proving Shane Battier's case, and just on an all-time 15-man roster, without thinking too much about it, but wouldn't you want to have Battier on that team? Doesn't he, out of all the Heat players that have ever played, wouldn't you want Battier on the 15-man roster if you're going to do an all-timer?
Absolutely.
For all the reasons we already talked about.
Absolutely. I mean, your chances of winning are exponentially greater with having a guy like Shane Battier on there.
So let's keep moving on. Jamal Mashburn, Glenn Rice, LeBron. I don't think there's any real debate here. I do miss... I'm not thrilled about not having Antoine Walker on here. Gotta tell you.
Wasn't he more of the four spot, though, while he was here?
Yeah, I guess he kind of was, right? I think overall for his career, because we had Shaq, him...
Right.
Posey.
Yeah.
They were kind of interchangeable, right? Yeah. Posey and Walker. They were more...
Yeah, Posey kind of guarded the four occasionally, but yeah. I mean, I think Walker, because of his overall girth, his heft, let's say, was capable of being more of the power forward, although he was going to camp out outside the three-point line regardless,
So would you put him on your top five power forward list?
Antoine Walker? no, I don't think I would.
He was the ultimate love-or-hate player while he was in Miami. I mean, he was it was like... I mean, we fans that maybe became Heat fans in 2010-ish for maybe whatever reason, right, don't remember Antoine Walker. But take Mario Chalmers and then times that by a bazillion.
Right, yeah. It's like,
because the highs were higher and the lows were way lower.
It's certainly seen that way, right? I mean, it's almost like, once Chalmers was actually being scrutinized by these later level Heat fans, the stakes were always higher, so mm-hmm. having a guy like Chalmers who's capable of such boneheaded decisions at times kind of takes all the joy out of being able to evaluate this team, I guess, because you're focusing only about wins. That was part of the problem for the 4 years of the Big Three era, is that the regular season was kind of overlooked because you knew you were going to go into the playoffs. You knew you were going to make a deep run, so he didn't take as much pride in the day-to-day wins. But a guy like Walker, I mean, you had your megastars in Wade and Shaq, and he was a guy who was fading in his career. Mm-hmm. But there he was, shimmying his way through the American Airlines Arena and knocking down 40-foot shots. I mean, a great quote about him, right? Why do you take so many threes? Because there are no fours. I mean, that's a fucking great quote. I want that on my gravestone. I've never shot a four-pointer in my life, but I mean, I want that on my gravestone. That's the kind of perfect quote that you want as far as a player like him is concerned. So he was a great part of Heat history, that's for sure.
So he's in the top five then. Okay, got it.
But, you know, another point, though, just to go back to small forwards, what a great line of really good small forwards that Miami's had as far as being, like, maybe a prototype for 3-and-D guys. You go back to Keith Askins was maybe your first in that regard. Then Bruce Bowen, who was a hell of a player in Miami and then in San Antonio. James Posey, Shane Batty, those guys – those are four of the best 3-and-D guys of all goddamn time, and they all started out here or got their start or got a some run here.
Certainly, the deepest position in Heat history.
That's pretty significant. The fact that three of those guys didn't even make the list is kind of ridiculous. Posey, Bowen, Askins is on there, but I mean, you could make the argument that maybe he doesn't deserve to be. But they were great parts of Heat history. And Bruce Bowen, I mean, he wasn't as necessarily as productive. Again, he was a complimentary player. Mm-hmm. Not a starter, but if you wanted to harass the opposing shooting guard into a bad shot, there's nobody better in the world than Bruce Bowen. Ask Kobe Bryant about that.
Yeah, I mean, when we were kids, we used to play the Bruce Bowen game. It was when we were playing pickup, it was the Bruce Bowen game was if you're playing defense, just kick the guy in the nuts. He may have never done that, but it was a testament to how physically and dirty he played defense. It was just...
Well, was it his move, so to speak, was always putting a foot under the shooter?
Yeah, putting a foot under, like, between the legs of the shooter, right? So it wasn't necessarily, like, underneath. It wasn't in, like, their landing spot, because if they landed on his foot and fell, like, it's a foul, but he put it, like, in between their feet.
It wasn't a foul at that point.
Oh, I guess you're right. It wasn't a foul.
Yeah.
That's a new rule.
Yeah, partly because of him doing it as a
Bowen, Bruce Bowen.
I don't know that he ever did it quite purposely. I think he was always just kind of sliding to guard somebody and kind of stuck his foot out because he had a wide stance, so to speak. Maybe it was on purpose. I don't think he's ever gone on record, nor will he, I'm sure, because Ray Allen complained about it. Yeah, the best two guards at the time, Ray Allen, Kobe, those guys, they really hated going up against Bowen because he was just all hands, all hands, always quick hands in your face, on your hip, trying to limit you from doing what you do best and being comfortable. And that was what made him great. But, Keith Askins, though, I got to go, a great story here. There was one time where, I don't know if you remember this from a long time ago, where Ron Artest, when he was with the Pacers, he threw, God damn it, who was it? I don't remember. He threw like a Heat player. I want to say Caron Butler, actually. I think he kind of was guarding Caron Butler during that year he was here in Miami. And he kind of knocked him down to the ground. And then he kind of stood over Butler a little bit in that crazy Ron Artest sort of way.
Yeah.
And then he started going at Pat Riley, kind of looked over him, being the tough guy from Schenectady that he is, and kind of told Ron Artest, like, cut the shit. What are you doing? Why are you going to do a cheap foul like that? And Artest started jawing at Riley. And this is when one of my favorite moments, assistant head coach Keith Askins puts the clipboard down from three rows behind the courtside seats there. And he comes over and he puts a hand on Ron Artest and said, "Don't you be touching Pat Riley." The way he rushed to Pat Riley's defense was perhaps one of the greatest moments in Keith Askins' history. I just had to go down that little trip there.
True Heat lifer.
Oh my God, it was amazing. It was he endeared himself to so many. I despite the fact that Artest probably outweighed him by 60 pounds, my money's still on Askins, man.
You got that old man strength at that point.
Something like that. And those bow ties, how can you deny the sharp bow ties on the sidelines?
Exactly. I do want to talk about Posey a little bit. The master of taking the charge.
We've had some good ones also in Miami,
We've had some really great ones, and he was terrific.
I still remember the mouth guard he had that was like split down the middle. Oh, that's classic pose, man. He was great. He was really great. I mean, only 2 years here in Miami, right? But he was just...
Seemed like longer.
Yeah, doesn't it? It seems like he had more of an impact. He was one of those guys. And I think he went on and had another title, didn't he?
Played with Boston.
Yeah, right? Him and somebody who else is on the next list, I think. A guy by the name of PJ Brown.
Ooh, nice little transition. Number five. Power forwards. Number five, I do have an issue with number five already, Brian Grant.
Okay.
Number four, Grant Long. Three, PJ Brown. Two, Udonis Haslem. And one, number one, obviously, is Chris Bosh. My issue with Brian Grant being number five at power forward is that he was a center in Miami due to, they needed him to play center, but he basically played center in Miami. So I don't love him being on the power forward list. But I do want him on one of these lists because Brian Grant was awesome.
You can almost make the argument then, seriously, using that kind of logic. And it's I'm not saying it's faulty or anything like that. I totally respect your point, Terry. You could almost make the case that Anthony Mason in his 1 year in Miami as an all-star, mind you, might merit some consideration as one of the top power forwards in Heat history.
So we take Grant off and put Anthony Mason in.
And leave Brian Grant off altogether?
And then put Grant on the next list for centers.
I don't know, man. That's a tough one. That is a tough one because there are some options there at center that I'll argue later on. But I don't know. I'm trying to think. I'm trying to go back.
Lamar Odom for 1 year. I mean, averaged almost 18 points and 8 or 9 assists a game.
Yeah, he was there. He was their point forward at the four. I mean, it was sensational in 1 year.
Yeah, he had a very great
exciting
year.
2003 team.
You know? I mean, he made the Shaquille O'Neal trade possible. If he didn't have as good a year, that trade probably doesn't happen, right?
Yeah, very good point. I mean, and again, I know Brian Grant was included in that trade for Shaq, but mm-hmm. man, that was a.
But he might have been the first one to leave the Lakers after, right? Like, because everybody that stuck was basically it was just Odom that stuck. Grant might have been the first one out.
Ron Butler signed, I think, or he was traded to Washington shortly afterwards, mm-hmm. and then Grant kind of floundered because he just never was the same after all those years going up against, like, big centers
right.
at that point. I mean, he was guarding Shaq. I mean, that's the kind of thing that they were asking him to do in Miami.
Right.
He was guarding Shaq. And another great Brian Grant story, though, you remember him going up against Yao Ming?
Yes, when he was, like, 2 feet shorter?
Yeah, yeah. and the quote from Steve Francis was that it looked like he had gone into a fight with a tiger because Yao Ming's back was all scratched and cut up, theoretically, from where Brian Grant had been, quote-unquote, defending him
yeah.
and trying to keep him from gaining position. Because, I mean, Yao Ming, he was a big mother. You know what? He was just a big dude, mm-hmm. 7'5", and he weighed like 300 pounds plus with tree trunks for legs. And, I mean, he clearly had leverage on Brian Grant, so Brian Grant had to go and do whatever he could. Maybe generously listed at 6'8", and put in all of his weight in there. I mean, he was a fine player while he was in Miami. And supposed to be,
yeah,
you know, the star here. He was part of that complementary role that he was supposed to fit in with Zoe when he was mm-hmm. supposed to be at full health. And unfortunately, you know, Zoe's kidney disease led to him being off the team. And so, I mean, it was just a bad, strange yeah. era in Heat history.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I kind of hinted at it before, but I'm glad you explained that. I think the reason Grant, and the reason I feel so connected to Grant, and I want him on one of these lists, is because of that emotional thing that we were talking about earlier, where, you know, he came over from Portland, and he was supposed to be that extra big man next to Alonzo Mourning. It was supposed to be a very formidable front, with Grant rounding it out at the power forward spot, and then that, you know, Alonzo Mourning has to leave the NBA, and Grant, by virtue of need, the Heat moved Grant to center, and he did his thing. I mean, he was scrappy. He was effective. The Heat went to the playoffs when Dwayne Wade was drafted and Grant was there. And you remember those great years. And then that team that was so tight and played very well together ended up and made the playoffs that first year, ended up getting blown up for Shaq. So it was a little, he wasn't here for a very, very long time. He was here for a while, but not a very long time. And I feel like there's a connection there that he was that part of that original gang that helped springboard the Heat into the Dwayne Wade era. And there's definitely an emotional tie there. But let's just keep moving along. I mean, Udonis Haslem, number two. I mean, another one of those guys that just put in his time and rose up the ranks in every leaderboard, every rebounding and points, minutes played category that the Heat have. And you got to love him being included on this. I think a lot of times people forget how good Udonis Haslem really was when he was at his peak.
Now, would you say that he really was that good, though? I mean, take aside the emotional part of it. I mean, maybe a little bit undersized at the power forward position, mm-hmm. but he certainly was a hard worker. Productive as far as giving maximum effort every damn time, whenever it was possible. And you wouldn't want anybody more in your corner when you're getting into a fight, but I mean, it's hard to make the separation with Udonis because he's so intrinsically a part of Miami Heat history over the 12, 13 years of his career. I mean, how do you separate the two? You always expect to see him. For me, now here's another question. Do you see him with the short fade now, or do you always see him with the cornrows?
I always see him with the cornrows.
Bingo.
Okay, he also had the question. He's got that afro thing too sometimes.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah.
Definitely the cornrows, absolutely. Cornrows, yeah, okay. But the main thing really is the cornrows with the mouth guard just like basically falling, like hanging out like a cigar, like a mafia man cigar.
Yeah, like that should be, if there's like a Heat memorabilia hall of fame somewhere.
Well, when we put the statue out front of American Airlines Arena, that'll be it. Or maybe him throwing his mouth guard.
Yes. Joey Crawford? That yeah. would be great. That would be awesome. I was just going to say that, so I'm really glad you brought it up, because that would have been perfect, yeah. A statue of tiny, tiny Joey Crawford, like maybe 5 inches tall off the ground, and an 8-foot-tall statue of Udonis Haslem throwing his mouth guard out. That would be perfect.
Or maybe just like a video board replaying that moment just over and over again.
Embedded into the base of the statue.
There we go.
You've got some good thinking there, buddy. Let me tell you, that is really impressive stuff.
It would just ignore all the other highlights of his career and just be that one highlight on loop.
I mean, what's the time where he was on the sideline and he was telling X player that he was going to blank you up? You remember? I forgot what player it was.
There's a lot of blanks involved in there. I'm trying to remember it.
You know which one I'm talking about, though? Like, yeah. Oh, Lance Stephenson.
That's right.
Yeah, it was Lance Stephenson talking smack, and then Udonis on the bench being held back by LeBron James because he's saying, I'm going to get in there, and you know what? And that's a great moment. And especially during those really contentious games between the Heat and the Pacers, you know, you knew there was going to be blood there. How about the time that he leveled Tyler Hansbrough after Hansbrough knocked on Dwayne Wade's head? I mean, you want a guy like Udonis. The fact that the big three took a pay cut specifically to accommodate a guy like Udonis, the number of times he sacrificed millions. I mean, I know people don't want to overlook that, or they don't want to give any credit to what happened there, but twice over the course of his career, he's renegotiated deals with Miami for millions. He did it in 2014. He did it in 2010. I mean, just what can you say? I mean, he is perhaps the most perfect Heat player of all time as far as just when it comes to symbolizing the team.
He absolutely, and just to kind of go into his stats, 4 years he averaged more than 10 points a game. 2 years averaged more than 9 rebounds a game. His best season came in 2007-2008, 12 points a game, 9 rebounds a game. Always had that mid-range jumper, never shot outside of his comfort zone. Has, I think, literally taken that's what I was about to say. 23 three-pointers in 13 years.
Yeah. I think 12 years. Chris Anderson shot that many last year alone.
Yeah. I should say 10 of them came last year in Miami. Remember Haslem started playing around with that three-point shot?
Yeah.
10 of them came last year in Miami. So before that, before he 13. Took, it was, he hadn't taken a
12 season.
In his first 4 seasons, because he hadn't taken a three-pointer since 2007 before that. It's amazing.
That's incredible.
So, I mean, Haslem, absolutely. And then, so what is it next for Haslem? Is he one of these guys that enters coaching when he's done? Is he one of the guys that kind of is right off to the sunset? How does he, or does he kind of go to a front office? Like, what's next for Haslem? He just seems like one of those guys to me that sticks around with the organization somehow, gets back those millions that he gave up.
To me, he opens up several more Subway franchises, and he becomes the community relations director or something like that for the Heat.
Okay.
Like, that's it. I mean, he's not – it's not to say that there's anything wrong with him. He's not coaching type as far as – I mean, the kinds of things that he could do, he's not going to go in there and coach. He's not going to coach up grit and toughness and no fear. You know, he's not going to do those kinds of things. He's not like Battier, who's going to be able to adapt to a more analytics-based approach to coaching or anything like that. So the kind of guy that Udonis is, he works best with the community, I think, and he'll continue to represent the Heat forever. And for all the times that he's been linked to trades and everything like that, I guess at this point in his career, all that talk is over, right? He's not going anywhere. Miami's not trading Udonis Haslem.
No, not happening. I think the last real spike in that was like 2 years ago when Evan Turner was available and the Heat said no. Thanks.
And he was struggling. I mean, he was struggling mightily. He couldn't do anything other than occasionally go in there and guard Roy Hibbert. And he did that very well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think he's going anywhere. And he's the Heat lifer. As much as we hate that cliche, he he kind of symbolizes it very perfectly.
Well, we're setting a record for saying Heat Lifer on one podcast, but I think that just kind of comes with the territory. But let's move on to center now. This is the hot topic one.
It's a good one.
I'm going to start from 1 to 5, because I think from 1 to 5, there's a little bit more suspense that way. Because we all know that Alonzo Mourning is number 1.
Okay.
Shaquille O'Neal is number 2.
Sure.
Ronnie Cicely at 3.
Yeah.
4 and 5 is where it gets fun. We have Hassan Whiteside at 4 and Chris Anderson at 5. That was the ranking published on allyoucanheat.com. Let's discuss. I'm going to let you start this one, Dave.
Well, I think both 4 and 5 should not be there. Like, okay. Hassan Whiteside, very good player in half a season, basically. Potentially a huge upside, but really not the kind of production that you'd expect. I mean, not enough to warrant his inclusion on this list. Not after just a few months.
My number one issue is that we included Whiteside on this list, but we didn't include Dragic on point guards.
Right.
I would have at least liked to keep it consistent. Maybe that's my fault as the editor of the site. Well, it is my fault. But
he was there for a little bit longer. Yeah. I think you could say that his production was probably greater.
That's also true. He did have an historic season. He did.
Yes.
So, yeah. Okay. Thanks for defending me.
For anybody who's listening who thinks that maybe I'm not in Whiteside's corner, don't get me wrong. I've written about him a number of times. I think he's the real deal, and I think he's going to be a great player. You and I have talked about the next step in his development on a number of occasions, but you're right. I mean, Cooper Moorhead from Heat.com wrote a great piece about how historically great Whiteside was, and he has been historically great. He set a franchise record for blocks against Chicago, huge games here and there. He needs to control his temper, obviously, but he seemed like he was getting better at that as the season progressed. So we are totally Whiteside supporters here on this end, but can you include him as the fourth best center in Heat history? And I know those numbers kind of get skewed a little bit because of Alonzo Mourning's longevity. When you think about it, Ronnie Cicely, possibly the first real franchise player for the Heat. He was here for a number of years. Then that era kind of segued to Alonzo Mourning in 1995 when Pat Riley joined the franchise. And then that kind of segued to 2004 when they acquired Shaquille O'Neal. So, I mean, you've had those three linchpins of the team for very long periods of the franchise history. So you kind of tend to think, well, then who really fit in between? How else do you get to that number 4 and 5? And I guess that's where Joseph had that kind of issue as far as who to put in those last two spots there. But I just don't know that Whiteside fits into that as much as I'd like to see other people fit into that spot.
So would you put Brian Grant over those two guys? If we're moving him around.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, you know, but he kind of alternated between power forward and center with Anthony Mason. He played a lot of center. I mean, he was really great at center. I guess you could kind of make that argument. You could also make it for Kevin Willis. I guess a lot of people forget that he was here for a couple of seasons. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Steve Smith was traded to Atlanta, and they acquired Kevin Willis as a result. And, I mean, you know, Willis was a former all-star, you know, those huge jacked up shoulders of his, huge arms, and a very short arm player in that sense. But, you know, he wasn't much of a passer. He was like the ultimate black hole from the center position. Once you tossed that ball in there, you weren't getting out. He was going to put up that baby hook of his a million times throughout the course of the game. But, you know, a hell of a rebounder, pretty productive in the limited time he was here in Miami. So you could make an argument for him. And I know that you and I have talked about it on a number of occasions that Ike Austin fit in very, very well here for a couple of seasons when he was a backup to Alonzo Mourning. He won the Most Improved Player Award for the NBA while he was here in Miami. And the only thing that hampered his impact in Miami was the fact that he was an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season, and Miami had to make a move kind of the same way they did for, you know, or Oklahoma City did for, you know, James Harden years ago. They traded him away knowing that he was going to cash in and get a huge deal that they couldn't afford to pay him. So they traded him to the Los Angeles Clippers for Brent Barry. And Ike Austin, for a couple seasons, while Zoe was hurting, I think he was going through a knee injury at one point, Ike stepped in there. They didn't miss a beat. And again, if you're looking at that 90s era Heat basketball, it's one of the greatest moments in Heat history. One of the greatest eras in Heat history, let's say. you know, Ike Austin was a good part of that because he certainly helped maintain the stability of the Heat front court when Alonzo was out. They had P.J. Brown, who was not a center, very good power forward, very good help defender, whatever. But Ike Austin was a big body, very good scorer, very good rebounder, solid shot blocker. It's just too bad that it just didn't work out for him. He got his big contract with the Clippers, and he was never the same player again. But you could easily argue that he deserves being on that list as well. So to me, you've got Kevin Willis, you've got Brian Grant, and you got Ike Austin, all of whom probably deserve more consideration than Hassan Whiteside.
So I probably would. I'm glad you mentioned Kevin Willis because I probably would have went with him in this top five. 14 points and 10 rebounds a game in 2 years in Miami. And unlike Ike Austin, went on for a few more years to be very productive. And before Miami was very, very productive. So, I mean, he wasn't here long. He was here for, like I said, two seasons. But had the numbers, had the production. I'm okay with Chris Anderson being in this top five because of what he accomplished and because of the impact that he had. I mean, the Heat don't win that first championship if Anderson's not here, right? He was hugely important in their playoff success, and so I'm okay with Birdman being on this list for the impact that he had, almost like a Jason Williams type inclusion, but. That Whiteside thing is tricky. It really depends. If you want to go just overall talent, Whiteside is probably one of the five best centers the Heat have ever had. But overall production hasn't been out here that long. There's a lot of other guys that could be included that have a greater body of work and longevity. So I think it's definitely debatable.
And you and I talked about this before we got on the pod. I'm not so sure. I'm not sold on Chris Anderson being a part of there. If you're talking about the limited, incredible production. Like, let's say he was decent for most of the time here during that first regular season he was here, and then he was really, really good during that postseason run in 2013, obviously. And then he re-signed here. So that's, again, now we're painting it with much more recent shades of nostalgia here, and that's affecting, I think, a lot of people's perspective on Chris Anderson's overall impact. I mean, you think about what he did when he first came here, you know, out of shape, couldn't really get up and down the floor, trying to give as much effort as possible, but he came in at just such a perfect time that led to that huge win streak, the second longest win streak in NBA history, that people kind of tend to forget that he wasn't necessarily a great part of that. He just, it fit in very well. If you had such crap at the center position, but maybe that's what it is. You know, you had historically or during the Big Three era such really bad, you know, players at the center position, that all of a sudden you had a guy who could rebound, who could dunk, who could, you know, give effort at least at a center. He wasn't Dexter Pittman. He wasn't the corpse of Zydrunas Ilgauskas. He wasn't Eric Dampier. You know, he was a guy who could be productive, but he looked great playing alongside LeBron James and playing alongside Chris Bosh and playing alongside Dwayne Wade, and that's certainly going to help a lot of people. It certainly helped Mario Chalmers, despite the fact that he thinks otherwise. But Chris Anderson looks a whole hell of a lot better playing against three Hall of Famers. And the fact that he was such a magnetic personality, that he was really humble, that he'd had all the legal issues and the drug suspensions and all the problems that he'd had in Denver and New Orleans, etc. And that he came in here grizzly, intense, quiet, weird, fantastic. I mean, I wrote about this a couple of years ago, but like for a city and a fan base potentially as superficial as Miami and South Beach and all that it includes, all the beautiful, glorious plastic people that call South Florida home and have such a premium on appearance, you fit a guy like Anderson in there with his mohawk and his body tattooed and I mean, just his overall appearance, and somehow that's all gone out the window. Like, they suspend all that superficiality and say, man, this is our boy, we love him. Despite the fact that maybe he wasn't as productive, now you can see why he fits in there as fifth. Is that, I mean, he's just beloved. This is again that what we first talked about with Jason Williams. I mean, he's, you know, maybe not as productive, but he was still part of something special, and that's why he gets that inclusion in there. But I'm not convinced that he deserves to be on there.
It's tough because you can go with the production that some other people had, like Kevin Willis,
right?
Or you can go with the guy that won two rings. And It's a tough argument to have.
Just one.
I'm sorry. You're gonna go with the guy that won a ring and but did win a championship and went deep in the playoffs and was part of some historically competitive great teams. It's a very tough. It just comes down to stats or rings, where it's so much of the NBA kind of comes down to that. But again, he wasn't responsible necessarily for winning those rings as much as maybe Dwayne Wade, Bosch, and LeBron were, but he filled a need and he helped that team get to the next level. So,
would you say that maybe the fact that he spurned LeBron in Cleveland in 2014 and re-signed in Miami, that that might have been something that that people look at so favorably, that that might put him at a little higher level than he had been prior to that? Let's say he spends 2013, half of 2013, they win a ring, spends 2013, 2014 with the Heat, and then he leaves via free agency, not necessarily to Cleveland like Mike Miller, but elsewhere even. If he goes to Cleveland, people will look back at that year and a half of the Birdman era and be like, he was a pretty decent player.
I think when you kind of look, when we separate ourselves a few years from now and Anderson's retired, I am interested to see how we look back on that and his place as far as top five centers. But to say he's a top five center in Heat history is, it just sounds weird, especially with the other talented centers that have come through Miami.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the all-time Heat roster. Who would you put at point guard?
At point guard, Tim Hardaway.
Yeah. I mean, if we go through the list, it's Tim Hardaway, Dwayne Wade, LeBron, Chris Bosh, Alonzo Mourning. That's your all-time starting five. That looks good to me. I mean, I don't have any... Those are all the number ones on here, so...
Yeah, I mean, you could debate who would be their key backups and everybody else, but I think you're right. That starting five has the perfect combination of toughness, integrity, talent, all the things that you could possibly look for in an all-time team. Could you make the argument that that might be like one of the better all-time teams in NBA history for like other franchises? I guess you could probably look at like historically great teams like the Celtics maybe or the Lakers and say that they probably have like better talent up and down as far as their overall mm-hmm. top five, but.
I think Boston, L.A. and Boston are your top two. Chicago has Jordan, Pippen. I mean, basically their 90s team.
Right.
And like Joakim Noah, I guess, you could throw him there.
yeah, I guess you're right.
That's still a very good top five, all-time starting five. I love the Heat starting five. I wonder if there's some other underrated with the Hawks all-time starting five. Right.
Mookie Blaylock? I mean, who else would they put up behind? I don't know. Oh, Lenny Wilkins, I guess.
Lenny Wilkins. That's who I was thinking. It was Wilkins and Dominic. I'm thinking maybe the Sixers? They had one of the historically great teams.
Well, they had Wilt at center, so that's...
Yeah, they do have Wilt at center.
Whenever you have Wilt Chamberlain, they're probably going to be pretty good. And they had a number of players during that Chamberlain era. There was Billy Cunningham. Allen Iverson. I mean, he's part of it. I think exercises like these, not only do they fill the time during a pretty dull offseason, but they, you can look back at a lot of those players and those versions of the team and think about the nostalgia associated with them, and the arguments that you and I just made up right now as far as whether you're looking at the statistics or whether or not it's within context of the team, and I find myself being somewhat hypocritical in that I'm trying to say, well, Jason Williams and Chris Anderson might not belong on there, but Dan Marley does. And it's just, I don't know. It's hard to separate the two, but isn't that what makes being a basketball fan great, is that you can't separate the emotions from everything that you're doing, nor do I think you should either.
Well, and that's what makes the sport so great, is because you can't, we are so quick to admit that it's more than stats, that this game is more than stats, that it's a beautiful game that's played between five guys who play offense and defense, and it's just a transition game, and there's so many things that go that are involved in this game, and when everything's on firing on all cylinders, it's just a great game to watch, and it's a ton of fun. But then when we bring these arguments to the table, it's, well, what kind of stats do they have? How many rings did they win? even though we're always so fast to talk about about how so much of this is luck, how much there is between the numbers that just doesn't go accounted for. And I think that's definitely what makes these exercises fun and worth doing during the off season when there's not much news going on.
Absolutely.
Any last comments, David, that you want to make? Any other last shout outs to some historic Heat players that might have not made this podcast? I'm trying to think of mine. I kind of had mine in Antoine Walker, I guess.
No, yeah. I mean, and I mentioned Ricky Davis. I mean,
yeah.
God, wow. Did you have like a favorite? Like, let's say not Antoine Walker because he was still pretty good. Do you have like a favorite Heat scrub of all time?
Ooh, favorite Heat. We can do another top five list of Heat scrubs.
there's a few, right? I mean,
Eric Dampier.
Eric Dampier, but he was a starter. I mean, maybe not. It's, again, tough to separate production versus that. But I mean, like, we're talking a guy like maybe a 15th man on the bench, you know.
I have a place in my heart for Jason Capono.
Oh, sure.
I wouldn't count him as a scrub either. He played a pretty important part for a few seasons as our 3-point ace. So, and he won the 3-point contest.
Right. Yeah, one of three Heat players, right, to win the 3-point contest. Glenn Rice and James Jones, I think, were the others.
James Jones is a good Heat scrub.
Yes. Yeah, again, you know, maybe again painted with the whole local flavor, you know, local guy who went to American High, he went to the University of Miami, and he played for some really good teams here, and he signed as a free agent before the Big Three era, so he spent a number of years here in Miami. He was a big part of that, or he was a good part of it, not necessarily a big one, but it was great knowing that he was part of that roster, so.
Yeah.
It's tough, right? There have been a number of players that you kind of just like look over there and hope that they'll pan out, and you know that they won't.
Okay. I'm trying to remember one other one.
Give me one sec. How about Gary Payton?
Oh, that's a good... I'm surprised he didn't make my top five point guards.
He wasn't very productive.
No, he wasn't very good at all.
I love that he won a ring.
We can talk about him.
Won his championship here after being a part of that debacle 2004 Lakers team. Remember the super team with Karl Malone and Shaq and Kobe when they were at their high peak of dysfunctionality. And Gary Payton, such a great player. I wonder how many people remember him from his time in Miami and even remember him from his time in Seattle before that. I mean, or Milwaukee. I mean, just the kind of player he was. He was so dynamic. Him and Sean Kemp with the Sonics and stuff like that. It was a really good team there. But anyway,
wouldn't count him as a scrub though. But good call out to an important part of Heat history of getting Gary Payton to come here. It was a little bit of one of those kind of first throwbacks to veteran signing for small contract kind of thing.
Good point.
How about Christian Laettner ending his career in Miami?
Yeah, didn't we? I want to say that at one point we had like four or five of the top picks in that draft. Like it was Shaq, Alonzo Mourning, LaPhonso Ellis. You remember him? And Christian Laettner. Like they were like some of the top picks. I think they were like the 1, 2, 3 in whatever years Shaq and Zoe got drafted. Mm-hmm. Was it 93 when they got drafted? 93, 94. I can't recall exactly what it was. Must have been 93.
Well, Laettner was 92.
Oh, okay. So if that was 90, okay. So they all got drafted in the same draft class, and I think it was Shaq, Zoe, and then Laettner was third.
And then, I mean, Laettner his last year averaged 5 points a game. I'm looking at his basketball reference page now.
Wow, I often forget the fact that he was here in Miami. Because he just had one of those really long NBA careers, but he never was quite. I think he was an All-Star a couple of times.
One time in 1996 and 1997.
Wow.
The 96-97 season with Atlanta.
Oh, that's right. He was with the Hawks. It's just tough to. I mean, because I remember him being drafted by Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and then I guess, kind of floundering around, although he had some apparently good years in Atlanta, and he played for a number of teams, and then again...
I remember him mostly in Detroit for some reason, just because it kind of fit.
Wow.
But he played with Washington before Miami. Obviously, yes. I remember him with Miami. I remember him with Washington.
He played in Washington with Michael Jordan when he was in the comeback year, right?
That's right. Yes, that's right. It was the ultimate team.
Him and young Rip Hamilton.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, so those are some big moments in Heat history. Where does, I mean, let's look at this Heat roster now. Anybody that really stands out? I mean, we have Goran Dragic just on Whiteside. I mean, Luol Deng we haven't talked about, and he's another 3-and-D guy, right. Sort of, kind of. Even though you might not want to be. Justice Winslow, I mean, he's a rookie. Who knows where he can end up? But this current Heat team now, I mean, with Haslam, with Chalmers still on the roster, I mean, some guys that are on these top five lists. I'm trying to think of who else that's on this Heat roster now that maybe stands a chance to crack one of these top fives.
You know who probably would be an unpopular pick, though, but he has all the potential, is Josh McRoberts.
Interesting.
Because he could play 4 years here, you know, the rest of his contract. And he could be like, he could get sixth man of the year consideration. He could mm-hmm. be a linchpin of a really strong, you know, second unit that comes in here. He could provide all the kinds of things that he did in Charlotte, where he's making pinpoint passes and shooting from long range and playing earnest defense occasionally. And he could become a beloved player in Miami, albeit one that might not necessarily have been as productive as a Grant Long or even a Udonis Haslam. But maybe he could find a way after 4 years, if he stays throughout the length of his contract, mm-hmm. he could be one of those guys that could be a very popular player in Heat history.
Like a Shane Battier pick almost, because he's kind of that same glue guy kind of guy. And 3 years from now, if the Heat win a championship or go to a finals or something, or they're uber competitive and they're the Eastern Conference finals all the time or something, and he's always there as that sixth man, like you're saying, then yeah, I could definitely see that. Interesting. I like that one. All right. Well, I think that's a great way to close out the podcast.
I agree.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave, for joining me. Good work as always.
Thank you, Wes. Likewise.
I think you're in my top five for greatest Heat podcast host of all time.
That's a short list, but I appreciate it.
The list's got to start somewhere. All right, thanks for joining us. As always, you can find the Heat Check on iTunes, SoundCloud. We're a part of the Hardwood Paroxysm Network over on Audio Boom and hardwoodparoxysm.com. Check us out in all those places. Leave us reviews. Say nice things about us, because we love doing this podcast and we love when you listen to us. So thanks to all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Made a promise to my mama that I'd bless her with some grandkids. She could spoil them. But till then, I'm getting dollars. I'm just doing what I gotta. Can a man live? And it's all day. I'm a god. Get a whole squad a job. Get them all paid. Came a long way from all state. Yeah, now we all American. Shit. We all American. Yeah, I swear to God, I put the hero in heroin. These flows, kilos. I can sell snow to a ski slope. I can sell evil to the devil. Non-believers to a temple. Shit, I can sell water to a speedboat. And these eyes is iconic. I went pro, made profit. Now I keep some dead faces in my pocket. Getting faded, I've been stoned all week. But what's a guy without a little OD? Just twisting my weed, easing my mind. Why you worry about me? Stop tripping, I'm fine. Swear these bitches done lost it lately. You put the hoe in on us, baby. So complicated. And I may be a little arrogant, I'm aware of it.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.